Welcome, AJ listeners, to a live reading of the Boston Globe. It is Thursday, July 30th, 2026, and as always, we thank our sponsors, the Mask Mission for the Blind and the Memorial Foundation for the Blind, and our special AJ volunteer, Corey, is back in the house. Let's give him a big round of applause. Corey, it's great to have you back.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be back.
Are you ready for the news today?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So let's get started. Our top headlines for today from the Boston Globe: Massachusetts lawmakers struck a deal on a bill that would protect immigrants from civil arrest in courthouses and schools. Another headline from the Globe today: the Citgo sign will feature all new parts and pieces when it returns to illuminate the skyline this fall. Up next, the Federal Reserve kept interest rates unchanged despite growing pressure to more directly tackle inflation. And finally, and you'll hear more about this later, Dr. Anthony Fauci repeatedly declined to answer Republicans' questions in a grilling on the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll be right back.
Would you like to hear news from Barry and Spencer that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Monday at 6 p.m.
At the top of the fold on the front page, Convention Center chief pulls out of deal. Barrows faced pressure after landing $2 billion contract to build Springfield Courthouse. This story is by Samantha J. Gross. Under immense pressure and a lawsuit challenging the deal, the head of the Mass Convention Center Authority said Wednesday that he is divesting from a controversial $2 billion contract with the state government to build a new courthouse in downtown Springfield. Through his attorney, Interim Authority Director John Barrow said he is also divesting from the company involved in the winning bid, Kojo Real Estate, which he owned with Conan Harris, the husband of U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley. Kojo was part of the team dubbed Liberty Junction that won the bid to build the project. We'll be right back. Up next, Clancy jury hears horror of 911 call. Ex-husband allowed to lead before tape played. This story is by Shelley Murphy. Patrick Clancy was led out of the courtroom midway through his testimony Wednesday, sparing him the trauma of hearing the 911 recording of his gut-wrenching screams as he told police his wife has killed their three children while he was picking up dinner. But the jury in the murder trial of his then-wife, Lindsay, heard the entire call, from the moment he found her injured on the lawn of their Duxbury home on January 24, 2023, after jumping out of a second-story window, to the discovery of the bodies of his children in the basement. He screamed she killed the kids. During the recording, several members of the jury fought back tears, and others appeared shaken. The recording was so graphic that Plymouth Superior Judge William F. Sullivan previously took the extraordinary step of prohibiting its release to the public, allowing only those present in the courtroom to hear it. Lindsay Clancy, paralyzed by her unsuccessful suicide attempt, sobbed uncontrollably in her wheelchair as jurors were led out of the courtroom for a break after playing of the 911 call. It was Patrick Clancy's second day on the stand at Lindsay Clancy's first-degree murder trial for the slayings of their three children. We'll be right back. Up next, the makeovers of their lives. With a new look, women feel the support they need after incarceration. The story is by Jessica Rinaldi. Women rebuilding their lives, some after incarceration, sat in brown leather salon chairs, wearing shirts that read, "Seen, Valued, Worthy." As stylists dressed in all black arranged their hair and painted their makeup at a salon on Monday before a professional photo shoot. The women were styled and photographed as part of an event hosted by New Beginnings Reentry Services, a nonprofit aimed at breaking the cycle of recidivism. As stylists carefully twisted curling irons, the salon filled with the smell of freshly heated hair. A makeup artist dabbed concealer and blush on a woman sitting in front of a softbox light. "You're doing such a great job," one stylist said, turning toward the artist. "She's looking delicious. This is something we don't do on a daily basis. Something we can't do in prison," said Stacy Borden, founder and executive director of New Beginnings. After decades cycling in and out of incarceration, Borden founded New Beginnings about 10 years ago to address the lack of support when she left prison. The nonprofit provides workforce development training, including interview prep and resume and cover letter writing, as well as a variety of healing programs such as music therapy, art therapy, group therapy, and yoga. It assists nearly 100 people each year, Borden estimated. We'll be right back with our next story. I'm still me, but different. Christopher L. Gasper details his prostate cancer surgery and recovery. Story by Christopher Gasper. The sportosphere loves a comeback story. I just never thought I would be writing about my own. Returning to work after a more than 6-week absence because of June 2nd surgery for prostate cancer has been gratifying, rewarding, humbling, and eye-opening. It feels familiar and foreign at the same time, mirroring my body. I'm still me, but different. Changed, chastened, more sanguine. I find myself brimming with empathy for athletes who suffer serious injuries and get taken away from their livelihoods, such as Celtic star Jason Tatum, who sat out for 298 days while rehabbing a torn Achilles. Your vocation and identity are snatched from you. The realization sets in that the pursuit you made the center of your world just goes on without you. You wonder when and if you'll return to who you were. Your world gets small. Simple functions you once took for granted, in my case, bladder control, sitting upright, traversing up and down stairs, they become tests of willpower and pain tolerance, then celebrated milestones. I received an outpouring of support from family, friends, colleagues, former athletes, fans, and fellow prostate cancer patients, including dozens of Globe readers. Yet there were times I felt completely isolated, propped up in bed watching a World Cup I couldn't cover, unable to opine on Jaylen Brown trade, or filled with thoughts about the Red Sox remarkable resurgence instead of the book I was reading. Like every athlete, I was confident I would beat the 4 to 6 week timeline for returning from my prostatectomy, performed by Dr. Douglas Dahl of Mass General Hospital, my Drake May. Nope, it took me about 6.5 weeks. However, I drew inspiration from my experiences covering sports. I thought about folks such as Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, Kevin Garnett, Kobe Bryant and Patrice Bergeron trying to channel their resolve and determination. We'll be right back. Our last story on the front page, no sense of urgency with state's report on guardians. This story is by Jason Laughlin. 2 years ago, the legislator gave state health officials a pointed directive. Tell us how to create a system of professional legal guardians to help the thousands of people who cannot make medical decisions for themselves, some of whom languish in hospitals unnecessarily. But the Mass Department of Public Health has yet to produce that report, and as of this week, it is a year overdue. It's like the bombs are going off around us, said Dr. Eric Dixon, chief executive of UMass Memorial Health. For whatever reason, there's no sense of urgency. Currently in Massachusetts, the position of legal guardian is effectively a volunteer job, yet they play a crucial role. Not only do they aid people in need, they also help rationalize the healthcare system. Those hospital patients who can't represent themselves but are medically ready to be discharged to a rehab center, long-term care facility, or a skilled nursing home need a guardian to sign off. Otherwise, they occupy hospital beds intended for more acute patients, contributing to overcrowding and lengthy wait times, healthcare providers said. DPH, or the Department of Public Health, said in a statement that its recommendations were delayed by additional data gathering and analysis, and that its report will be out shortly. DPH is committed to supporting patients who cannot represent themselves, said Ann Scales, the agency spokesperson. This includes addressing the shortage of medical guardians, as well as work to increase the number of people who have healthcare proxies in order to reduce the need for guardianship. She added that the state had spent $118,000 so far on a contractor, Eastern Resources Group of Boston, to gather information for the report and communicate with stakeholders. Even the state representative who sponsored the law requiring the study of guardianship said he has not heard from DPH why its recommendations are late. It's not uncommon for any state agency to delay, said Thomas Stanley, a Democrat from Waltham. I think the common refrain is that they have all sorts of work to do, and there's not enough time or resources. But Stanley added it's crucial for the legislature to have recommendations from DPH if it wants to fix the current system. DPH's findings are expected to include a deep dive into the financial impact of state-supported professional guardians, including an evaluation of the possibility of paying guardians through MassHealth, the state Medicaid system. All right, we're going to hear a public service announcements about the ways to listen to Audio Journal, and then we'll be right back with Corey.
Did you know that there are many different ways to listen to Audio Journal? You can go to our website, audiojournal.org, and stream us live. Or you can install the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. Or you can tell your smart speaker to play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or you can dial us at 1-712-770-1043 on your telephone. Or you can turn on your local cable access TV station. You can check our website, audiojournal.org, for the correct channel for your town. And finally, you can use one of our special receivers tuned to Audio Journal's frequency. And if you missed your favorite program, go to our website or the Audio Journal app and listen to podcasts of previously aired programs. Now, if you need assistance with any of these listening methods, please contact us at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
And now for today's The Nation's First Story. Fauci takes the fifth at contentious Senate hearing. Will face a contempt of Congress vote in a Senate committee next week. By Lauren Neergard and Ellie Swanson, Washington. Dr. Anthony Fauci on Wednesday repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment and declined to answer dozens of questions from senators in a Republican-led committee hearing about his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. The decision, at least for now, shielded Fauci from answering questions that could expose him to accusations of lying under oath. Though he did receive a pardon in early 2025 from the Democratic President Biden, some Republicans pursuing a years-long campaign for his arrest had suggested he could still face charges for any perjury committed during Wednesday's hearing. The scientist who helped lead the nation's COVID-19 response was subpoenaed to testify under oath by Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who has long had an antagonistic relationship with Fauci. In response to angry, sometimes mocking questions from the Republican senator, Fauci declined to answer more than 100 times, injecting new drama into partisan divides that have festered for years about the origins and handlings of the pandemic. Fauci himself has become a polarizing figure, even receiving death threats that prompted him to seek security. In his opening statement, Fauci said Paul has an obvious obsession with calling for my persecution. The only conclusions I can reach is that the sole reason he is calling me before this committee is to get me to say something, anything, that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up, in his words, quote, behind bars, unquote. Fauci said, adding that while it pained him to do so, he was following his attorney's advice by taking the fifth. Paul, who has long argued that Fauci should be criminally investigated based on his belief that the scientist was dishonest in previous testimony to Congress, announced that the committee will vote next week on whether to hold Fauci in contempt for declining to answer questions. He did not say whether he would push for criminal contempt referral to federal prosecutors or another charge. He also raised questions about whether Fauci's pardon affects his eligibility for Fifth Amendment protections. In the combative hearing, Paul and other Republicans accused Fauci of lying in early testimony about the coronavirus origins, something the longtime National Institutes of Health scientist has forcefully denied. Democrats called the hearing a politically motivated attempt at entrapping Fauci and praised the scientist for his work during the pandemic. With Fauci declining to answer questions throughout, Paul dominated the approximately three-hour hearing, listing a litany of accusations and detailed questions. "Today will be the capstone to Anthony Fauci's 40 years of abuse of power at NIH," Paul said. "History will judge, but the facts as we now know them, paint a sordid tale of dishonesty, misjudgment, and ultimately the hubris the likes of which the world has never seen." In a heated moment during the hearing, Paul ejected Fauci's attorney, David Shurtler, from the room after he tried to speak without being recognized. Shurtler said the removal was outrageous and demonstrates the complete bias and baseless nature of this proceeding. In another statement, he called Powell's accusations about Fauci's false and disgraceful. The Democratic senator praised Fauci and said he didn't deserve the treatment he was getting. "This hearing is designed to entrap you," said Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire. Leading up to the hearings, Paul released more than 1,000 pages of Fauci's personal diary covering the pandemic years, pointing to some notes about early efforts and understanding how the virus emerged. Paul said on social media that what Fauci wrote privately and what he told the country are two different stories. Some of the diary entries, including Fauci's uncertainty in the pandemic's earliest days as scientists around the world raced to understand the new virus and how best to curb it before vaccines could be created, already were reflected in a 2024 memoir and in interviews at the time. But they have nonetheless drawn attention from people who blame Fauci for mask mandates, school closures, and other policies they believe infringed on their rights as hundreds of thousands of people were dying. President Trump on Wednesday wrote on social media that he stopped relying on Fauci over the course of the pandemic because he felt the scientists made bad decisions about masks, shutdowns, and other issues. He later told reporters he watched the entire hearing. Scientists also scrambled to Fauci's defense ahead of the unusual hearing, the second time he has been back before Congress to discuss pandemic origins since leaving government in 2022. While the COVID-19 pandemic introduced him to millions of Americans, he talked the nation through numerous outbreaks over the decades, including HIV, Ebola, and the 2001 anthrax attacks, while advising seven presidents. In a public letter, more than 150 infectious disease experts and other scientists wrote that no credible evidence has been produced to support these absurd charges, and that they are urging elected officials to stop these witch hunts. Among topics discussed at Wednesday's hearing was whether NIH-founded research in China may have played a role in how the pandemic started. Many scientists believe the virus most likely emerged in nature and jumped from animals to people, coming to light when it spread at the wildlife market in the Chinese city of Wuhan. Fauci has long said publicly that he was open to both theories, but there's more evidence supporting COVID-19's natural origins. For our next story, a threat of mold may be unrecognized. New York. A first-of-its-kind U.S. study suggests invasive mold infections may be an underappreciated and potentially deadly threat. The researchers detected about 450 cases in Atlanta area hospitals over 5 years. About a third of the patients died in the hospital. The findings published this week by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention come from an attempt to better gauge how common these kinds of illnesses are. The government does not require doctors to report the illnesses. It's kind of the first time we've had an estimate like this, said the CDC's Dr. Jeremy Gold, the study's senior author. And it's important to understand it now because the problems may grow in the future, he added. Mold exposure is a recurring problem with the hurricanes, floods, and the other natural disasters influenced by climate change, researchers have found. I agree that the frequency of fungal infections will likely increase with climate change, said Dr. Jeffrey Jenks, infectious disease researcher at Duke University. Meanwhile, there's a growing population of older people who are more susceptible to such illnesses, Gold said. Invasive mold diseases are a rare infection caused by certain species. Most people who get infected inhale mold spores, but they can also enter the body through cuts or wounds or from contaminated medical equipment. The spores don't cause health problems for most people, but they can be life-threatening to some. Our next story. Wisconsin's ruling supports anti-union law. A Wisconsin appeals court on Wednesday restored a 2011 law that abolished collective bargaining rights and a setback for unions and public workers. Unions are expected to appeal, sending the case to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which is controlled by liberal justices. The 2024 ruling striking down the laws as unconstitutional had been on hold pending appeal, so Wednesday's reversal does not change the status quo. The law remains in effect, as it has been the past 15 years. The enactment of a 2011 anti-union state law, championed by Republicans, sparked weeks of protest and made Wisconsin the center of national battle over union rights. The law effectively ended most public employees' abilities to bargain for wage increases and forced them to pay more for health insurances and retirement benefits. Supporters of the law say it gave local governments more control over workers and the power needed to cut costs. They argued that repealing the law, which allowed schools and local governments to raise money through higher employee contributions for benefits, would bankrupt those entities. Opponents argued it has hurt schools and government agencies by stripping employees of the rights to collectively bargain. Stephen Colbert receives free speech honor. Stephen Colbert, whose 11-year run as host of The Late Show was defined in part by his feud with President Trump, has received an anti-censorship award from a foundation established by the author-publisher Ishmael Reed. Colbert was among the recipients of the 47th Annual American Book Awards. They were announced Wednesday by the by the Before Columbus Foundation, a nonprofit group based in Oakland that champions diversity in literature and culture. CBS ended Colbert's program in May, removing a high-profile platform for one of Trump's most prominent critics. The network cited economic reasons for his decisions. Colbert and others have questioned that explanation. The foundation also honored a range of literary releases, from Nicholas Boggs' Baldwin, a biography of James Baldwin, to John Fugelsang's Religious Critique, Separation of Church and Hate, to the poetry collection Variations in Blue by Adela Najaro. Novelist Karen Tai Yamashita received a Lifetime Achievement Award. With Blanche's nominations at stake, he hedges on payouts. Huge payments to Trump ally comes to light. By Devlin Barrett and Alan Foyer. 2 days before Senate lawmakers were scheduled to vote on advancing Todd Blanche's nomination to serve as Attorney General, a million-dollar payout was announced for an anti-abortion activist he has called a victim of government weaponization by the Biden administration. The settlement given to Paul Vaughn, who was convicted by a Tennessee jury in 2024 of conspiring to prevent access to an abortion clinic, shows how the goal of a $1.8 billion fund announced in May can continue despite a public retreat by Blanche. An already existing avenue for disbursing taxpayer money could allow him to assuage skeptical Republicans while fulfilling President Trump's desire to pay people he believes were wronged by the Justice Department. Vaughn will receive a seven-figure settlement from the government, his lawyer said, making him among those aligned with the administration who have received a payout by an alternative means. Since 1870, the Justice Department has handled claims for civil compensation against the federal government. Such claims can be filed through public lawsuits or privately through forms sent directly to the department. Vaughn, whom the president pardoned last year, has insisted he is innocent and accused the Biden administration of misusing a law meant to ensure women and healthcare professionals have unobstructed access to reproductive services. The settlement was reached by his lawyers at the Thomas More Society, which often represents anti-abortion activists, in April, but first disclosed Tuesday in a statement that said their client had been prosecuted for political reasons and as a part of a government weaponization effort against people who oppose abortion rights. The continuing ability of the department to make such payouts with or without a formal fund structure is one of the sticking points between the Trump administration and Republican senators as they wake amish the nomination of Blanche, currently the acting attorney general. A single no from a Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee could stall or sink his nomination, and Thursday's scheduled vote was in doubt after some crucial holdouts expressed skepticism. In May, the Justice Department announced that it would resolve a lawsuit from Trump demanding at least $10 billion from the IRS by establishing a fund intended to compensate his supporters, raising the possibility that taxpayer money could be funneled to January 6 rioters. A related provision barred the IRS from pursuing audits of past tax returns of Trump and his relatives. Senator John Cornyn, a Texas Republican, has voiced the loudest concerns on the committee, saying Wednesday that he would not support the nomination of Blanche unless he provided written assurances about the end of the fund and the tax provision. Blanche publicly defended the fund as necessary for victims of lawfare and weaponization to be heard and seek redress. Democrats called it a brazen slush fund meant to steer huge sums of taxpayer dollars to the president or president's supporters. Despite his public retreat, Blanche has resisted providing a written guarantee to the courts or Congress that the fund will not come back in some forms. 2 weeks ago, Judge Kathleen M. Williams of U.S. District Courts in the Southern District of Florida wrote that she was extremely troubled by Blanche's answers to the Senate about the fund. Williams called one of his answers at best misleading and at worst disingenuous. Another federal judge, Leonie M. Brinkema of the Eastern District of Virginia, has left alive a lawsuit seeking to dismantle the fund. She said the case remained open because Blanche and the Justice Department had refused to file an affidavit under penalty of perjury, that they will not take any action to create or operate the payout fund, and that it will not proceed in any manner under any name. Blanche has pushed back against such demands, even as he promised lawmakers in June that the fund was dead. He said, "I'm not committing to putting anything in writing." The reason for creating the fund, he also told lawmakers, remains as important as they were before. And we'll return.
When my dad started to lose his vision, we were worried. Sure, his doctor gave me and my mom some handouts, and I did my fair share of research. But we had no idea how much of a challenge vision loss would be or how it would impact his quality of life. That's why I was so glad we discovered Mass Commission for the Blind. They work with my dad, and they will work with you and your loved one as well to develop future plans and new skills and assistive technology. They even helped Dad get access to talking books and newspapers. He was so excited.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
And now on to some world news. Our first story, Israeli settlers sneak into Syria to try for outpost. Israel's military has occupied the area in southern Syria for more than a year, but forays by civilian settlers into the region have only recently became a regular occurrence. The story is by Natalie Meltzer. The Israeli military was about to launch a nighttime strike on a group of men in southern Syria when the soldiers noticed the long curls dangling from the temples of their targets. The troops held their fire. These were not Syrian militants attempting to breach Israel's border, but religious Jews who had slipped into Syria and were on their way back. The episode, first reported last week by Israel's public broadcaster and confirmed to the Associated Press by the Israeli military, has helped raise the profile of a fringe group of Israeli settlers that has staged numerous incursions into Syria where they hope to establish Jewish settlements. Israel's military has occupied the area in southern Syria for more than a year, but forays by civilian settler groups into the region have only recently become a regular occurrence. I apologize. I think I reread that paragraph. The most prominent of the groups behind the incursions in Syria is known as Pioneers of Bashan. Formed early last year, the Pioneers of Bashan are a group of right-wing Israeli activists aiming to establish Jewish settlements into Syria. They are named after the biblical region of Bashan, which includes part of modern-day Syria and neighboring Jordan. They have their sights set on an area of southwest Syria that includes the provinces of Quneitra, Dara, and Sweida. Part of this area, including the summit of Mount Hermon, is a buffer zone Israel declared in December of 24, soon after the ouster of former Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in an insurgent offensive. Members of the group claim a historical right to these lands and argue that their presence there will help Israel defend the Golan Heights, which Israel captured from Syria during the 67 war and later annexed, a move not recognized by most of the international community. We'll be right back. Our next story, rescue crews comb for trapped survivors. The Temblor in the Kumamoto area on the main island of Kyushu also left at least 62 people injured, six of them seriously. Japan. Soldiers and emergency workers comb through a badly damaged shopping mall and collapsed houses looking for trapped survivors Wednesday after a powerful earthquake that killed at least 18 people, including a foreigner, in southwestern Japan. The magnitude 7.1 earthquake that hit a day earlier in the Kumamoto area on the southern main island of Kyushu also left at least 62 people injured, six of them seriously, the prefectural government said. The tally has been steadily growing, fanning fears it will continue to rise. Some of the most serious damage was at the Aeon Mall shopping center in the town of Kashima, which was bustling with thousands of people when the quake happened. The company said some 3,000 customers were evacuated to a parking lot before a gas explosion happened in another part of the mall where some people were still working. Fumika Ono was shopping at a mall with her older sister when the ground shook so fiercely she lost her balance and ducked. Children began screaming and goods scattered on the floor. The 19-year-old was among the crowd of shoppers who managed to escape safely. The hot weather heightened worries about the survivors as rescuers braved the heat. It remained unclear how many people might still be missing. We'll be right back. Our next story comes from the Dominican Republic. Zoo offers haven for exotic species, tackles Dominican Republic's rise in smuggled animals. The only zoo in the Dominican Republic is providing a safe haven for confiscated illegal and smuggled animals as a government crackdown aimed at protecting exotic species gathers pace. Tucked inside a green oasis in the middle of the capital are crocodiles, flamingos, and even tigers that officials have confiscated from people accused of illegally keeping them. The numbers are growing and threaten to overload the zoo. "It's a burden," said Alfonso Ferreira, deputy director of the city's National Zoological Park. "People have a predisposition to owning wild animals." Dominican authorities seized 188 animals last year, compared with 30 in 23, as the government tries to tackle the illegal ownership of certain species. It has also launched campaigns to raise awareness about their plight. So far this year, officials have confiscated more than 8,900 species, though a majority were crickets and fish to feed animals. "Flamingos are often the most rescued animals," said Nelson Garcia Marcano, head of the Caribbean nation's Department of Wildlife Regulation and Control. "Flamingos are often illegally taken from their natural habitat and sold to hotels, which use them as garden ornaments," he said. "It's a trend individual homeowners have started to follow. People like to copy what they find attractive and beautiful," said Garcia Marcano, noting people sometimes amputate a bird's wings. "It's a migratory animal," he said. "It's an animal that should be free." On a recent hot morning, a reporter visited a flock of rescued flamingos that sought shade in a private section inside the zoo. Some of their typically bright coral feathers were white, as if they had been bleached. Ferreira explained that their captors usually fed them white bread instead of the algae and tiny crustaceans their bodies require. To reduce the number of flamingos featured at hotels across the Dominican Republic, Garcia Marcano said they have suggested staff embrace species including the purple gallinule, a crane-like bird with iridescent feathers. At the zoo, the rescued flamingos receive carrots and bird feed and are rehabilitated for several months before some are released back into the natural habitat. Nearby, several crocodiles sat without blinking in individual cages filled with greenish water. They too had been snatched from their natural habitat and kept as pets. Encompassing 309 acres, the zoo is big enough that a small train ferries visitors to exhibits, but resources are stretched. Territorial animals such as crocodiles must be isolated, which requires more cages and more funding. "Before, we only received parakeets and parrots," said veterinarian Tatiana Carreno Pinto. "Now we have a much wider range of species arriving at the park." The zoo is also preparing to take in exotic animals confiscated in neighboring Puerto Rico as part of a deal reached last year, including caimans seized from suspected drug traffickers. We'll be right back.
Trump said to have asked for details of agent Comey's interview. Washington. Secret Service agents who questioned former FBI Director James Comey were told to quickly send a written summary of the interview to President Trump on Air Force One, according to a new court filing by Comey's lawyers seeking to dismiss criminal charges over social media posts. The disclosure, included in internal government documents turned over to Comey, is one of the most glaring examples to date of the degree to which Trump now directs federal law enforcement actions. Comey posted a photograph of seashells on a beach arranged to read 8647 to his Instagram account on May 2025, and the president's supporters quickly denounced the post as a threat. Comey denied that, saying he had understood the term 86 to be restaurant jargon for expelling an unruly patron. The number 47 refers to the 47th president, Trump. The Justice Department brought charges in April, deeming the photograph as a threat to assassinate the president. Comey's lawyers, in their filing, urged the judge to dismiss the case as a vindictive and selective prosecution based on the president's longstanding personal loathing for Comey, who served as Trump's FBI director until Trump fired him in May 2017. Comey also sought to have the charge dismissed on the grounds that his social media post was protected by the First Amendment as non-threatening political speech. Moreover, he has urged the judge to scrutinize the grand jury proceedings for any indication that prosecutors misled members of the panel to secure the indictment in the case. A Justice Department spokesperson declined to comment. The filings offer more detail into the length law enforcement agencies went to pursue Comey hours after he shared, then deleted his post. Earlier reporting by the New York Times described how the Secret Service spoke to Comey on the phone, trailed him as he drove from vacation home in North Carolina to Virginia, and asked his cell phone service provider to give authorities real-time tracking information about his location. Graham returns to South Carolina one last time with his funeral. Senator Lindsey Graham returned for the last time Wednesday to South Carolina, where powerful friends remembered him as someone who never stopped working for the state he loved. After Graham was eulogized Tuesday at the nation's capital as an indefatigable dealmaker by the president, vice president, and others, mourners in Columbia recalled him as the son of pool hall owners who was born with a plastic fork in his mouth, a former Representative Trey Gowdy put it. The Republican seemed to know every mayor and small town police chief and the location of every Chick-fil-A in South Carolina, and made sure GOP candidates had money to run in legislative and local elections across the state. Lindsey Graham understood the hopes and dreams and needs of his state and delivered every time, said Republican Governor Henry McMaster, who ended his remark by telling Graham he loved him. Graham died suddenly on July 11th at his home in Washington, likely an aortic tear, according to preliminary findings. He had just returned from a whirlwind trip to a NATO summit in Turkey, where he celebrated his 71st birthday, and a visit to Ukraine as he negotiated punishing sanctions against Russia. Senators voted late Tuesday to advance the package as a final gesture for their colleague. Wisconsin judge declines to give absentee voters a do-over. Madison, Wisconsin. Wisconsin voters who have already returned their absentee ballots for the state's primary are not allowed to void those and request a new one, the judge ruled Wednesday. The ruling deals a blow to Democrats who filed a lawsuit seeking to give voters a do-over because of a chaotic party primary in the governor's race. More than 117,000 absentee ballots had been returned by Wednesday. Democrats were concerned that many of those might have been cast for Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez, who had been seen as a Democrat frontrunner before she dropped out on July 17th amid a campaign finance scandal. A day later, Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, who had bowed out on July 8th, reentered the race. Rodriguez's name remains on the ballot along with a former State Economic Development Director, Missy Hughes, who dropped out in June. The bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission voted 4-2 on July 9th to distribute guidance to clerks saying absentee voters cannot change their ballot after it has been returned. The rarely used process is known as ballot spoiling. Democrats objected and supported the lawsuit filed by three voters, arguing the state law allows voters who have submitted an absentee ballot to change their minds before those ballots are counted on Election Day. Obama makes endorsements with a basketball video. Des Moines. Barack Obama, the only Democrat to win Iowa in a presidential election in the last quarter century, famously loves basketball. Josh Turek, the Democratic nominee in the state's high-stakes Senate race, does too. He was a two-time Paralympic gold medalist on the U.S.'s men's wheelchair basketball team. So for one of the former president's first endorsements of the midterm election, he appeared in an endorsement video shooting hoops with Turek, a centrist state lawmaker who is seeking to become the first Democrat to win a Senate seat in Iowa in more than a decade. Last week, Obama joined Turek at a gymnasium in Chicago, where they filmed a 2.5-minute video while playing a game of Iowa, a variation of horse that shoots around the game. Democrats are trying to flip the seat held by Senator Johnny Ernst, a Republican who decided not to run for election. Turek faces Representatives Ashley Hinson, a moderate Republican running with President Trump's endorsement. Let's go. We playing horse or what? Obama, who had the White House tennis court modified so it could also be used for basketball, says from the sidelines in the opening moments of the video released Wednesday. Turek replies with grins, "We're playing Iowa." "I know a little something about winning Iowa," says Obama, who upset Hillary Clinton in the Democratic race for president in 2008 and carried the state in the general election that year. He also won Iowa in the 2012 presidential election, but the state swung sharply in 2016. Trump carried it by nearly 10 percentage points. 31 Iowa counties pivoted, the most of any state. The Republicans have since maintained a hold on Iowa, and Trump won it comfortably in 2020 and in 2024. Opinion polls show the race between Turek and Hinson essentially tied. Turek has argued the state is ready to elect a common-sense Democrat.
Our next story, Trump wants the Supreme Court to help him control who gets to vote. After a string of court losses, the administration is begging the justices should stay out of it. This is from the Boston Globe opinion section by Kimberly Atkins Storr. The Trump administration is on a legal losing streak in its efforts to take unprecedented control over state voter registration rules. So it's asking the Supreme Court for emergency help to turn things around. The latest defeat came Friday when a federal appeals court upheld a temporary block on President Trump's executive order seeking to impose nationwide limits on some voters' access to mail-in ballots. On Monday, the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court justices to interrupt their summer break to issue an emergency order allowing the executive order to be enforced. If the justices grant the administration its wish, it would amount to a rare victory for Trump and his ongoing efforts to sow American distrust in the election process, while also making it increasingly harder for people who are less likely to vote Republican, namely people of color and naturalized citizens, to cast ballots. Thankfully, there have been plenty of obstacles in his way, even from within his own party. For example, despite Trump's insistence that lawmakers passed the Save America Act, which would change federal law to require documented proof of citizenship, mandate photo identification be shown at polling places, force states to share their voter rolls, and more, the measure is getting pushback from Senate GOP leadership, all but killing its chances of passing. On the legal front, the Justice Department's lawsuits against 30 states and the District of Columbia for refusing demands to turn over election-related records have so far been unsuccessful. So far, 17 have been thrown out of the court, and none have resulted in a state being forced to give up the data. Judge after judge has rejected the administration's lawsuits because the DOJ provided no adequate basis for the request for the data under federal law, and the government failed to state a valid purpose for collecting the information. In fact, Judge Thomas E. Johnston of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of West Virginia, a Bush appointee, wrote that one is left to wonder what the real purpose was for the Justice Department to go to the trouble of filing civil actions like this one all around the nation. The answer seems clear. Based on Trump's long history of making baseless claims that elections are rigged and untrustworthy, punctuated earlier this month with a primetime address to Americans that was full of fear-mongering but devoid of actual evidence of fraud. He wants to put roadblocks up for voters, particularly in blue states, while laying the groundwork to claim fraud if the election results aren't to his liking. But the legal hits against him keep coming. Democratic officials in 23 states, including Massachusetts and the District of Columbia, are challenging Trump's executive order directing the U.S. Postal Service to only deliver mail-in ballots for people whose citizenships are cross-checked against a national voter list. That list is being complied using a program called Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements, or the SAVE program. Elections experts have warned that the system is prone to errors, and even the since-resigned Republican Secretary of State in Texas, Jane Nelson, warned federal officials that it was incorrectly flagging U.S. citizens. In addition, the order would force states to issue ballots with secure envelopes with unique barcodes that can be tracked. It would bar state officials from providing ballots to eligible voters who are not on the federal voter list. Penalties for not complying range from the loss of a state's federal funding to the threat of criminal prosecution of state officials. Well, that wraps up the opinion section for the Globe, and that's all we have time for the live reading of the Boston Globe for Thursday, July 30th, 2026.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
Once again, Audio Journal listeners, this is Bill Ruggiero giving you the latest weather forecast for Thursday, July 30th, 2026. Here's my latest Thursday forecast. For today, we'll have periods of showers today, highs in the lower 60s. For tonight, mostly cloudy skies with an early evening shower, otherwise clearing after midnight. Lows will be in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny skies with a brief shower in the afternoon, highs up into the mid-70s. For tomorrow night, mostly clear skies, lows in the mid-60s. And the outlook for Saturday is calling for mostly sunny skies, highs up in the lower 80s. That, folks, is your latest weather forecast for Thursday, July 30th, 2026. This has been Bill Ruggiero saying have a good and happy day, everybody, and please stay tuned for more programming up next on Audio Journal. Take it easy, everybody. Have a great day. Bye.
You say you love a good book, that you enjoy listening to a good story that piques your interest, which challenges your imagination to explore places where it has never gone before? If so, then Audio Journal's Backyard Bookshelf is for you. Backyard Bookshelf is Audio Journal's award-winning book reading program that always has a local flavor, featuring books about New England as well as books written by local authors or native New Englanders, be it fiction or nonfiction. So join us, won't you? Just tune in every Friday at 4 p.m. and enjoy. That's Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal.
Are you elderly or disabled? Did you know each WRTA fixed route bus has a number of accessibility features such as a ramp to enter, a kneeler which can lower the bus, a securement area for wheelchairs and other mobility devices, priority seating for people with disabilities, electronic signage on the front, side, and rear exterior, a bicycle rack on the front exterior, an interior stop request sign, automated audio and visual stop announcements. Let us make your transportation needs easier and ride the bus with us. Call us with questions at 508-791-9782 or visit our website at www.therta.com.